and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, National Executive Director of the ACLU, Anthony Romero. His talk, entitled Disparate Opportunity in America, The Ongoing Struggle for Equal Rights, was recorded back on July 14th at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium. Former Anchorage Police Chief and Public Safety Commissioner of Alaska, Walter Monaghan, began with Anthony Romero's introduction.
Good evening. You know, it occurred to me when Jeffrey asked me to say a few words here, what would a longtime police officer, what would they want to agree to in regards to coming down and speaking in an ACLU meeting? I thought about it just for a quick moment and realized that, in essence, all along, our missions have always been the same. We would just like people to follow the law. So I accept it. Thank you for being here tonight. On behalf of the Alaska Native Justice Center, I've got a few words that kind of paint the picture of what it is for the Alaska Native here in our state. Have you ever been given any thought to why we teach American history? Certainly it filled the time between lunch and PE when we were in school. But what it was meant to do is to give each of us a sense of who we are and where we came from as a people, as a nation. It taught us to be proud and to see where we sat amongst the nations in this world. And embedded within each chapter whispered one of our more revered American values. Yet American history is written, like all history is, from the perspective of the dominant culture. In our case, it is the Western culture. It took years of activism and sacrifice to get the contributions of the African Americans moved beyond slavery to mention the heroic campaign by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. American Indians, our first Americans, are still briefly referred to in our history books in the myth that is Thanksgiving, or in the snickering way how the island of Manhattan was bought for $24 worth of beads. And then there was that Indian woman that may have helped our great explorers, Lewis and Clark. But where is it that there's any mention in our books about an Alaskan Tlingit woman named Elizabeth Paratovich, who with her husband Roy and many others helped pass this nation's first anti-discrimination law 20 years before the great work of Dr. King? If truly we are ever to boast about being a nation of equals, then we must first acknowledge and accept each other. It begins in the beginning, so let's start with education and teach it with the inclusion of history of all Americans. And after we get that, maybe we can start to turn around the fact that Alaska Natives, who have the highest dropout rates in the state, can start to succeed. And then we can begin to impact its subsequent issues in healthcare, unemployment, substance abuse, crime, and suicide. Categories that are sadly led by, in percentage, by Alaska Natives and American Indians. Today's challenges of Alaska Natives are staggering, but have you ever reflected why? Certainly Westerners didn't find them this way. You know, for thousands of years, Alaska Natives not only survived, but flourished in some of our world's harshest climate. They did so because that within every tribe and village, there was an order, a structure, on how they lived. An order and a way of life that was severely disrupted or destroyed when Western government and religion came in our own self-righteous and condescending way and viewed these cultures that are thousands of years old as primitive and savage. After dismantling their internal infrastructure, we taught them Western ways and the promises of what civilization can bring. Yet all the while, keeping them just outside of the gate of acceptance. And though we have had an Alaska law against discrimination since 1945, strengthened by the U.S. laws that followed, subtle forms of it still remain. It may be hard to detect outright, but its effects can be seen in the litany of challenges listed earlier that include unemployment and substance abuse. Still, I am comforted by hope. Hope that Western society senses failure in its old methods and seeks new ones, such as the advent of the therapeutic courts, where defendants are viewed as people, not just case numbers. Hope for the Alaska Natives that have braved so many storms for thousands of years will brave this one too. And hope that comes from the fact that I believe in you. I believe in all of us. Thank you. It's now my honor to introduce to you Mr. Anthony Romero, the Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union. In the past 10 years, under his leadership, ACLU has countered such issues as the U.S. Patriot Act, the torture, abuse, and indefinite detention of detainees in U.S. custody, and the abuses of our spying program, just to name a few. Given all that, Mr. Romero still had time to co-author a book, In Defense of Our America, The Fight for Civil Liberties in the Age of Terror. Please, let's give a warm Alaskan welcome to Mr. Romero.
Thank you, Walter, for that kind introduction. I must tell you that when I was informed earlier today that I would be introduced by a former police official, a state trooper, I said, it's totally fine as long as he arrests me after the speech and lets me get the speech out, I don't mind. But actually, I'm delighted to meet Walter and had heard much of your courageous work here in the state of Alaska. And it's in fact very often that we align and we have coincident interests with individuals in law enforcement. Our work at the ACLU, like the work of many law enforcement officials, is to keep Americans both safe and free. And they're not a Faustian bargain that you have to trade off with one another. In fact, there's often much alignment and much coincidence as we think about those issues. And so I want to pay tribute to Mr. Monaghan and to all the fine men and women who serve us in uniform to keep Americans safe and free, both here in Alaska and elsewhere. I'm delighted to be here at the University of Alaska, and I'm delighted to be here with our colleagues of the ACLU affiliate in Alaska. This office is one that often punches above its weight with the work we do in the State House and in the courts. And I was truly thrilled to see the extensive nature of our docket as I was preparing for these set of remarks, and really want to pay tribute to Jeff Mittman and his colleagues here at the ACLU of Alaska because they do remarkable work. You've got the best. We've got some of the finest staff that we have anywhere in the country here in Alaska. This is my first time visiting Alaska as director of the ACLU, and it's a very different place for a native New Yorker born in the Bronx like me. I think there are more people living within the 5 subway stops in the Bronx than there are in the whole state of Alaska. You have the midnight sun here. We didn't even have the streetlights on at night in the Bronx. But there are some important similarities, an odd sort of link between New Yorkers and Alaskans. And even though Sarah Palin might try to disavow them, I think there are some very unique similarities between New Yorkers and Alaskans. People in New York and Alaska, we share a pride in overcoming obstacles that day-to-day life in both places and in contexts look daunting for most Americans and what most Americans don't experience. We share a real feeling that there's a tremendous opportunity to be seized, even if you have to work twice as hard as anyone else to get there. There is already, I can sense, and from colleagues and friends who are Alaskans, I see the fact that there is this Alaskan mentality that also says, live and let live. And don't mess with me. That is refreshingly and gloriously American. And the struggle to make it in America is one that's been the American dream. It's one where we've come a very long way in our two centuries of existence, but it's one that's yet not fully realized. For most Americans who are disadvantaged, poor, or minority, this is not the legendary land of equal opportunity. There's a caste system too often, as we just heard about the Native Alaskans, that puts people in a lower class status even while they're reminded or told that they're equal to everyone else. If you're black and poor in this country, the odds are often that you'll stay poor. There's a study that showed that there's a 50% chance that you're going to stay poor and black if you're born to poor and black parents. Odds that are 65% higher if you're born white. There's a study by the Economic Mobility Project, which is a Pew initiative, that showed that only 31% of black children born to middle-income parents make more than their parents' family income, which is compared to 68% of white children. Of even greater concern is almost that half of black kids whose parents were solidly middle class end up falling below the bottom of the income distribution ladder as compared to only 16% of white children. The idea that if you're born to middle class parents and black, and that you have a greater chance to fall behind your parents is really a racial issue. It's one that's not just about the land of opportunity and working as hard as you can and pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. Very often for low-income and minority families, that struggle is one that's more about the racial barriers that they confront. I was reading as I was preparing for this set of remarks in the land of Sarah Palin about some of the libertarian economists. No, I like to know the worst of a place so that I can always be pleasantly surprised about the best. And I've not yet met Governor Palin, former Governor Palin, but there's an economist, Ludwig von Mises, who said, quote, "The idea that political freedom can be preserved in the absence of economic freedom and vice versa is an illusion," he wrote. Political freedom is the corollary of economic freedom. Now that's a Tea Partier I can agree with. And it's looking precisely at the corollary between economic freedom and political freedom on the other side that I wanted to address my remarks to you this evening. For more than 40 years, we've had cynical political leaders that have made limiting freedom and opportunity in minority communities a way to get themselves elected into office. The result has been a perpetuation of poverty and racial inequality in a nation that commits itself to equal opportunity under the law. Politicians don't talk in terms of limiting freedom in minority communities, but they've accomplished it. Look at what they've done. The war on crime is increasingly creating an underclass. The assault on political participation of minority group Americans has disenfranchised generations of minority Americans. And the subversion of due process rights, especially in this time of economic unrest and uncertainty, has had a brutal disproportionate effect on struggling families in minority communities. Let's start with the criminal justice issue. Back in 1968, Richard Nixon campaigned for president on a platform that focused on the war on crime. This war on crime was a barely concealed assault on so-called activist judges who had advanced civil rights. But it was also a very bold attack on minorities who had the audacity to stand up to racism and brutality wherever they confronted it. It was a famous part of Nixon's Southern strategy, where Nixon exploited the resentment of bigoted and difficultly situated whites to win Republican votes in a previously solidly Democratic South. It was a strategy that was so clear, so articulated, so fraught with racial undertones, that years later, the chairman of the Republican National Committee actually apologized for the Southern strategy to the NAACP. The problem was, the Southern strategy worked. Ever since then, political candidates of both parties, both Democrats and Republicans, have upped the ante. The war on drugs, mandatory minimums, three strikes, you're out. All of this played on latent bigotry, all of them wreaking disproportionate effect on minority communities. Now, national research and surveys show that white Americans use drugs at approximately the same rate as minority Americans. In fact, young people, young white people, are more likely to sell drugs than minority youth. But guess what? 3/4 of those incarcerated on drug charges are black or Latino. We see this in communities all across this country. When the police pull up to a suburban strip mall and line up every male of age 30 or more or under up against a wall and pat them down, there would be outrage if that were to happen in white suburban communities. It happens all the time in inner cities that are predominantly black, Latino, and minority. In 2009, for instance, the New York City police stopped and frisked 575,000 people. The reasons they gave in the police reports, which we litigated to get copies of those reports, were, number one, they were pushing up these individuals against the wall because of furtive movements. That was mentioned in 50% of the police reports that we reviewed. Another 30% of the police reports talked about the individuals casing a victim or a location. Now, when you're in New York and you're black or brown, and the police pull over 575,000 people in 1 year who are just walking down the street, it's hard not to look furtive. It's hard not to be casing a location when a cop is on the corner. Not surprisingly, 90% of all those frisked in New York, 90% were black or Hispanic. The stops resulted in arrests slightly higher for white suspects, and whites were 55% more likely to carry a gun in those arrests. So you start with the fact that minority Americans are many more times likely than whites to get swept up in the criminal justice system. But then you add in the overworked and underpaid public defender system, and then you season that with the tough on crime sentencing policies like mandatory minimums and three strikes, you're out. And all of that becomes a recipe for a new form of Jim Crow. America's prison population has grown from 500,000 in 1980 to more than 2.3 million today. The incarceration rate for all crimes is 6.5 times higher for black males than it is for white males. And even after serving their time, many of these people are stripped of their rights and relegated to a second-class citizenship status. A minor pot bust for an affluent white kid in the suburbs can be humiliating, difficult, can create tensions with the family. If that pot bust goes to court at all, his record is probably going to be expunged at some point with the help of some competent legal advice, perhaps a sympathetic judge who's known to his or her family. But for a minority poor urban kid or adult, a minor pot bust can be a life-changing event. The arrest can cost them federally guaranteed student loans. It makes them ineligible for government benefits. They lose the right to live in public housing. They will confront employment discrimination for employers who don't wish to hire anyone who has a criminal record. And it strips many of those individuals with their voting rights for years, if not for their entire lives. I was thrilled to see that the ACLU of Alaska had joined other affiliates in working against this violation of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And we find these unfair and these flawed criminal justice policies sweeping against too many minority Americans all across the country. If the criminal justice system had been explicitly designed to push black and brown people, especially young men, back into a segregated society reminiscent of Jim Crow, it could hardly be more effective than what we find today. Take now the question of political power. We find that 5 million Americans who have been arrested on the war on drugs, that a huge proportion of them, black or brown, are now ineligible to vote for their, because of their felony convictions, even after they've done their time. With this hardened stance on the war on drugs and the war on crime, we've lost sight of some fundamental American values that were always a part of the way we viewed America. The idea that once you've done the time, that you're free to live your life. That we believe, fundamentally in rehabilitation. That American ideal of redemption that goes so deep in our communities, in our culture, in some of our religions, is now lost. And you can find in any context the idea that the individual can redeem him or herself. Think about the prodigal son returning back to his father. Think about the teachings of turning the other cheek. Think about those early lessons you learned from your mom and dad, where you were told to treat others as they wanted, as you wanted them to treat you. And yet, in the context of criminal justice and political rights in America, we've lost that very heartfelt and deep-rooted sentiment on the value of allowing others to redeem themselves. In Nevada, when we prepare our voting rights handbook to explain how a former felon can receive his voting rights, that handbook takes 2.5 pages to explain how you might get your rights back. Some people get their rights back when they finish their sentences, we explain. Others have to petition the courts of conviction for restoration. Those with federal convictions need a presidential pardon to have their voting rights returned in Nevada. Imagine, a felony federal conviction requires the President of the United States to allow you to vote for him or her in office. In other states, we find a new form of poll tax. In Tennessee, the ACLU is challenging a law that requires ex-felons to pay money based on their convictions and on the court fees, or if they're behind on their child support before they can get the right to vote. Now, if you're a wealthy felon, if you were happened to arrest someone at Goldman Sachs, for instance, who happened to live in Tennessee, they'd be able to buy their voting rights right away. But if you're working a low-wage job and have a felony conviction, or if you're unemployed, the odds are that you can't ever buy your voting rights back. I don't think it's a coincidence that the election of the first black president of the United States has encouraged and occasioned a violent resurgence of ballot security measures specifically designed to keep poor black and brown people away from the polls. I was pleased to read that here in Alaska, the ACLU made opposition to one such measure, HB 162, that would make a restrictive law and disallow individuals to get their voting rights because of these ballot security measures. I know it's back on the 2012 session, but I'm confident with all of your help in this room that we'll beat it back a second time. Turn now to the economic issues. Having looked at the crime issues, the political rights issue, let's look about basic issues of economic fairness. Economics has always been a part of the civil rights struggle. Martin Luther King once wrote, "Our emphasis must be twofold. We must create full employment, and we must create incomes." King, along with others, understood that class prejudice and racial prejudice went hand in hand and often reinforced each other. That's why when you have local laws that impose penalties on businesses that hire undocumented workers are incredibly insidious. It's difficult to make the case that because you have a green card or because you're a U.S. citizen, You have full citizenship rights when a potential employer is just too afraid to hire you. We were part of the ACLU, the ACLU lawyers were part of the team that recently challenged the Arizona employer sanctions law. And, yes, and unfortunately, that case, which was before the Supreme Court, which I sat in the back of the court as I heard that argument, was one that we lost by a one-vote margin. It turned on these rather esoteric points, the idea that the state of Arizona would issue a license to a business to conduct commerce in the state of Arizona, whether or not it was appropriate then for the state that was giving this business license could require employers to guarantee that none of their employees were undocumented. Our point of view was that the question of immigration is left exclusively to the federal government. That is one of the few places articulated in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, where the plenary powers of Congress trump any actions by the states. But the right wing of the court, led by Justice Roberts and Justice Alito and Justice Scalia, I've never heard Clarence Thomas ever open his mouth. I guess one day I might hear him speak from the Supreme Court. They kept making the point that, well, this isn't really about plenary powers in immigration. This is about whether or not a state that's been given the right to issue a license can then have certain conditions on it. And so it was this dancing on the head of a needle, where whether or not it was about immigration law, it was about granting a license to a business. And of course, the court, often too bent on an ideological outcome, found any number of ways to back itself into an outcome that was ideologically predetermined. We're lucky that that ruling is relatively narrow. And as we bring up the next ACLU lawsuit, the one that's against the SB 1070 law that makes it a requirement of police officers to pull over anyone that they believe they have reasonable suspicion to believe they are undocumented, we believe that we stand on much firmer ground. Now, reasonable suspicion to believe that someone is undocumented is essentially pull over anybody who you think is black or brown. Now, if a good old boy from Alabama with blonde hair and big blue eyes, 6'4", wears a big sombrero he picked up in Tijuana and a poncho, I find it really hard to imagine an Arizona state trooper is going to pull him over. If you happen to be 5'3", with dark charcoal black hair and ruddy brown skin, wearing precisely the same clothes, I can almost guarantee you that you're much more likely to be pulled over by a cop in Arizona. This law that essentially requires police officers to pull over individuals who look different than majority Americans, white Americans, is an invitation for racial discrimination. We had a similar case that we fought and won 3 years ago in Hazleton, Pennsylvania, where again you had a local police chief who was angling for white votes to get him reelected, basically made it a crime to rent or to employ or to contract with undocumented individuals. In the trial that we had in Hazleton, I also attended that trial, we heard from our plaintiffs, many of whom were American citizens, some of them Puerto Rican, some of them Dominican, some of them from Texas. One of them in particular ran a local Hispanic food store where you could buy rice that was Hispanic or beans in the can, Goya products, some of the fruit juices that you can't find in the ShopRite or the A&P. And the police officers would actually come into his store and stop individuals as they were shopping for their goods, asking them for their papers. Now, can you imagine anything more likely to kill a business than having a cop pull over your customers in the aisles of your supermarket? When we made that case and made that argument in Hazleton, we were lucky that we drew a judge that was appointed by Ronald Reagan. He probed the issue very deeply and I'm not being sarcastic. It's very, once we won that case, it was very hard for the right wing to dismiss the outcome of that lawsuit. Because if even a Reagan-appointed judge, in his thorough questioning of the defendants, could see that this was nothing more than just racial discrimination and prejudice dressed up in a new cloth, then we can make that case, I think, much more eloquently in places like the Supreme Court as we challenge the Arizona law. Turn now to the way in which the economic meltdown of the last 4 years have had an impact on individuals who are poor. In Michigan, we find a new form of debtor's prison. When I went to law school, I thought that the whole idea of being incarcerated because you were poor and couldn't pay your debts, I thought that went with the British king, that was eliminated. I find myself now learning more and more about some lawsuits that we have to bring because the debtor's prisons have new life to them. In Michigan, the state law would impose what they call legal financial obligations, LFOs, on individuals convicted of minor crimes. Individuals who were unable to pay their child support due to a disability or unemployment, or because your child had been in legal trouble, and therefore you had to pay back the fees that the state incurred in those prosecutions. Consider the case of our client, Edwina Nolan of Escanaba, Michigan. Edwina was working part-time, literally trying to move from the lowest rung of the ladder to one step above. She was literally trying to move from homelessness as a homeless woman to find her own place to live. The court ordered Edwina to pay $104 in court supervision fees for her 16-year-old son who had done a brief stretch at a juvenile detention center. When she couldn't pay the $104 to reimburse the state for her son's time at a juvenile detention center, she was denied a court-appointed attorney, and she was sentenced to 30 days in jail for contempt. After serving the 30 days in jail, she was released and worked one day to pick up a check for $178, enough to pay the original $104 legal financial obligation. When she went down to the courthouse to pay the LFO, she was told that it's no longer $104. Now you have to pay $120 for the room and board that her son had while he was in a juvenile detention center, and another $22 for the drug test they administered to her son, which came back negative. And since she only had $178, and now she was looking at $252 in fees, they put her back in jail. The ACLU of Michigan was fortunate enough to win her release because we said that she had been arrested unconstitutionally, that her ability to pay these fines violated her basic due process rights, and the fact that she had not had an attorney to defend her was anathema to the American ideal. Now, it's hard to imagine a more surreal catch-22 situation. You impose an unpayable debt on an individual who is homeless and not able to work. You jail them for not paying it. While they're jailed, they can't work. Then you impose additional sums of money in addition to the original fine, and their debt continues to grow. And then you throw them back in jail, ensuring the cycle of debt and legal action continues in perpetuity. Now that's one stark case of one woman who struggles to put herself on solid footing. In Florida, we have a case that has resonated with a much broader part of the American public. We're on the cutting edge right now of looking at the mortgage industry that is literally stripping thousands of homeowners of hundreds of millions of dollars in wealth without any due process. Almost 500,000 foreclosure cases are pending in Florida. The Florida state legislature, so concerned with this backlog of foreclosure cases, allocated $9 million to create a new special foreclosure court that would be staffed by retired judges and whose rules fundamentally departed from the established rules of civil courts. In litigation we had using the Freedom of Information Act, we found emails back and forth between the chief judge of these foreclosure courts and the other judges on the bench, talking about the need to push aside some of the concerns around due process, push aside some of the notice and consent requirements, push aside some of the questions around evidence, and let's just deal with this backlog of cases. One of the ways they did that was with the robo-signing you've read about in the newspapers, the idea that rather than have one individual sign off on all the foreclosure orders, you just have this machine that would sign 9,000 of them in a week. After we got the information on how these courts were functioning, or rather malfunctioning, we filed a petition in a Florida appellate court charging that the foreclosure system in this one county, Lee County, was basically denying due process rights to homeowners. Our client is a woman who's facing foreclosure after leaving her job to care for her husband who was injured in a car accident, found her house in foreclosure. She endeavored to have her case moved to the civil courts, the civil division of the county court system, and she was declined, saying, you don't have the rights of going to the civil courts anymore. You have to deal with these new foreclosure courts that cut the corners. And you find that the foreclosure crisis has had a disproportionate effect on low-income and minority communities. Our client is one of the 25% of Lee County residents who are Black or Latino. What you also find is the fact that these matters are really quite different when you look at the foreclosures in elite and affluent neighborhoods, whether in the Upper East Side of New York, or in Bel Air, or on the north side of, or the north side of the lake in Chicago. What's increasingly clear is that America espouses a commitment to equal opportunity and that everyone is treated fairly under the law. But over the years, when we've seen both in questions of crime and punishment, on voting rights, on due process related to economic matters, that you have a very different system when you deal with low-income individuals, individuals who are disproportionately Black or brown. Now, there's no silver bullet in any of these efforts. What requires us is to continue to work assiduously wherever they arise. The work to defend liberty and freedom is not just some esoteric effort to talk about these aspirations of the founding fathers. Our work at the ACLU is not on behalf of some parchment that's behind some glass in Washington, D.C. or in Philadelphia. Our work day to day is to take those aspirations and make them real. Make them real in the lives of individuals like Edwina. To give life to those core American values that make us be proud to be Americans. That when you think about what makes us unique and proud as Americans, it's not about the wealth of our nation. It's not the ability to wage wars and win them. What makes us proud as an American when we say the Pledge of Allegiance or we sing the Star-Spangled Banner are some core values that make us proud to be who we are. That we're all equal under the law. That you have the right to due process. That you're innocent until proven guilty. That you believe in the values of redemption. That you believe that if you're given a fair chance, you can make it in America. Those are the values that inspire us at the ACLU day by day. It's work we've been doing for 90 years, and it's work that we'll continue to have to do for 90 more and 90 more and 90 more years after that. That for as long as you have an America, you're going to need an ACLU. That we have to be and have increasingly become a permanent part of the American political landscape. Because these freedoms and these rights are not self-executing. They require individuals and institutions and clients with the courage of America's convictions to stand up to the injustice and the indignity, to say, I demand more. America deserves better. And that we understand that that work is in front of us, because freedom can't defend itself. We have to defend it for all of us and for the generations of Americans who follow us. Thank you very much for your patience. I look forward to your questions and comments.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage with Anthony Romero, National Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, also known as the ACLU. He was recorded at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium in Anchorage on July 14th. Following his talk entitled Disparate Opportunity in America, the Ongoing Struggle for Equal Rights, Mr. Romero responded to questions from audience members.
I wanted to ask about the bail bond industry.
Yeah.
I heard a story on NPR about the role of the bail bond industry in Lubbock, Texas, basically altering the way that release on recognizance programs were working in the courts, and that they, in a sense, conspired with the legislature to require people to use their services in order to be processed through the court system. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, for those of you who may not understand it as well, when you're charged with a crime and indicted, the judge makes a determination, you enter a plea, whether you're guilty or not guilty. If you enter a not guilty plea, then the judge will have to determine whether or not to release you on your own recognizance, which is a nice word for saying, okay, we know you're gonna probably come back, but we're gonna let you out on your own recognizance. Or in many instances, they want you to post bail. Very often, the posting of bail is not because you worry that the individual is a flight risk. That's often the terminology that's used. Whether or not you're more likely than not to return to the next court hearing or the next or the part of the trial. There are often individuals who have homes in their local communities, and the judges ask them to post bond. And it's very unlikely that someone's going to abandon a home they own and not turn up for a hearing in local communities. And increasingly, especially in low-income and minority communities, the bail bond industry has been a booming business. It's an essential part of the criminal justice system. And for those who don't have the ability to write the check out right then and there off their bank account, you then have to go to this private bond provider and use whatever assets you have as collateral, often paying very high fees, these usurious fees. And it's, again, if you violate the terms of your bond, then the fees become higher, and then it revolves back through the criminal justice system. It's the one we've been looking at. I'm trying to look for the fellow who asked the question for me. We've been looking at the bail bond system. They vary from state to state. Texas is among the worst of them. And it's especially hard because you're dealing with private businesses in the context of the criminal justice system. And one of the reforms that we've put forward in some jurisdictions that are more amenable to them has been to ask the states to exert greater oversight and regulations over the bond industry. In some local jurisdictions, we would encourage some of the local police chiefs to provide some form of a bond financing system directly through the state governments as a way to disincentivize those individuals who would exploit individuals in the criminal justice system. It becomes hard to challenge them in court. Much of the work we have to do is through legislative efforts. It's the same problem we have with private prisons, that you don't have the same level of scrutiny or ability to sue private prisons, privately run prisons, as you do those that are run by the government. And so it is a matter that's going to require additional energy and attention. Yeah, the next question, please.
My name is John Havelock, and I'd like to thank you for a very articulate explanation of our problems, particularly with what our system is doing with respect to minority rights. But I was a little troubled by your statement of the equivalence of political rights and economic rights. A lot of what I hear today is the federal government is trying to take away our economic rights by regulating our banking practices, et cetera, et cetera. And this connects to a problem, frankly, that I've had with ACLU positions, even though I'm a supporter of the ACLU, that the problem being that that economic freedom has enabled the very wealthy, through corporations and otherwise, to buy up the means of communication and the access to communication.
Right.
So there's a total corruption of our system. And the ACLU's position has bothered me on that, because going back to Buckley against Vallejo and your support, as I recall, you also supported Citizens United, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And I think that the ACLU was wrong on those points for their failure to recognize that there is a balancing of rights that needs to go on,
sure,
and that we cannot allow this current system to continue. I'd like your comment on that.
Sure, sure. First, thanks for that great question. And let me be clear. There is a very different way to approach economic rights from civil and political rights. The U.S. courts have not found these economic and social rights justiciable in the same way that the right to vote or the right to free speech. And so I don't mean to equate them at all. Although I will also point out that some of the most important work of the civil rights movement has focused specifically on the economic disparity between minority groups and majority groups. And it's not a coincidence that it's the Commerce Clause that has often been the foundation by which you have uprooted some of the Jim Crow laws and the racial discrimination clause, the efforts to integrate public accommodations to deal with employment and housing has always had a very strong undercurrent around economic opportunity within the civil rights laws. And I think very often when we have these debates within the ACLU, we talk about economic rights as being separate and distinct from political rights or civil rights. It's a dichotomy that's, I think, drawn all too starkly. To your point, though, around campaign finance, let's be clear. The political system is fundamentally corrupt. And we've always believed that, in fact, the influence of money on politics has a very disparate impact on the poor and empowers those who are wealthy, especially corporations and wealthy individuals. The place where we have perhaps parted ways with you and some others in our ranks is on the solution. And we've always espoused and believed that the best way to ensure an equal playing field in the political system is on public financing of our elections. That it's not necessarily a fait accompli that the person who spends more always wins. We see that in the context, for instance, of the governor's race in California, where you had Governor Brown spending much less than Meg Whitman in that campaign, and yet she lost famously to Jerry Brown's much smaller campaign. What we've always believed in the campaign context is that you have to have enough money to make an election viable, to have your point of view expressed to voters, to have them understand what you stand for, and that once you hit that threshold, who spends more may be less of a difference than who has a bigger budget. That being said, the Citizens United case is a complicated one. We did file a brief in the Citizens United. The Citizens United case, for those of you who don't know all that well, was a lawsuit that was brought by a number of groups. We filed an amicus in it. There was a movie that was prepared by some independent right-wing groups that was attacking Hillary Clinton during the last election. And there was an effort to ban that film as a form of political speech and independent expenditure by her opponents. And what we argued is that that film and the ban on broadcasting that film should not be upheld. That the film attacking Hillary Clinton is precisely the type of political speech at a time when it matters most in an election that should be allowed to be broadcast. And it was very specific to that film and that context. And the court had always taken these cases, many times in the Supreme Court, they take individual cases and they apply the individual facts and circumstances and an as-applied challenge, not a kind of a broader ruling. In a remarkable, I say remarkable sarcastically, example of judicial activism from the right, the Supreme Court that could have held very narrowly that the ban on that film was inappropriate and contrary to the First Amendment went further. They said that corporations could make direct contributions to political candidates for office. They went over step one and went to step 2000 on an equation that they should not have reached as aggressively as they did. And you see that in some of the dissents, individuals who may have agreed with the outcome of not banning the film, but disagreed with the way the court got there. And so Citizens United is enormously troubling. It's not a position, the outcome of the court and the final ruling of the court was not a position the ACLU espoused. Our position was much more narrow and limited. Where we find ourselves now in Citizens United is really a conundrum, I gotta tell you. I don't know how to fix it. It's unlikely that the Supreme Court is gonna take another case in the near term that's gonna undo the Citizens United precedent. So what are we left with? We're left with disclosure requirements in terms of if corporations are gonna put money into candidates' coffers, at least we ought to know that Exxon is behind blank candidate. So that's something we're very much behind. The other way to approach it, which I don't support, would be a constitutional amendment process. The idea that you'd actually try to have an amendment to the Constitution, which would be the only way to undo the finding of the Supreme Court. And that would be a debacle in this political context. If you have a debate about amending the First Amendment to limit the ability of corporations to contribute to candidates, I guarantee you that that very narrow remedy you try to fashion for Citizens United is going to grow enormously. And you'll find a ban on all sorts of political players in the political process that you might want to have them in the process, whether it's labor unions or not-profit corporations. And so it is a question of enormous concern. And frankly, with this most recent case by the Supreme Court on the Arizona public financing case, which is another shot across the bow on public financing, you're gonna find it increasingly hard to come up with public financing schemes that work. And the Arizona case that the court decided was a mechanism where if candidate Y spent $1 million and candidate X spent $1,200,000, then candidate Y would be matched up to a certain amount, and if the second candidate spent more, the first candidate would get more, if the second candidate spent even more, they would be matched. And this whole kind of equalizing from across the two candidates they found to be problematic. They thought that you either give the full amount of money you need to run the election up front, which is a disincentive for the states to enact campaign financing regimes, or you just set the base. And that's going to make it increasingly hard for any state to take on a public financing scheme. And so we find ourselves in this very difficult situation where I think the most important thing that we can do is on the disclosure front. And from an ACLU perspective, the idea that you provide the public with the information it needs to make its own mind up, that they know that Exxon is backing this one candidate to 100% of his campaign expenditures, and the public still votes that person into office, that's politics, that's democracy. I think with disclosure requirements being strengthened, I think the American people are smarter than that. That's the one remedy I still see that's before us. But thank you for your question.
Yes, I know other questioners are lined up. I just have one. You obviously haven't changed my mind entirely.
No, I know. This is a place where reasonable people will differ at the ACLU.
But the one remedy I would suggest you think about is that arises from the Arizona case you first mentioned, that is the notion that because Arizona licenses an organization, they can attach conditions.
Yeah.
As far as I know, almost all American corporations are incorporated by states under state law.
Yeah.
And if you can attack this on the state level, you could legally, it seems to me, and constitutionally have a provision that requires corporations that make political contributions to canvass their voters, their stockholders,
yeah,
and get that approval.
Yeah, that's been
would not happen in almost every case, I'm sure.
That has been hold on to their money. That has been talked about. That's
right.
Absolutely true.
Thank you very much.
You bet. How about somebody else? Anybody else with a question or comment? You don't have to get up to. Oh,
yes,
great.
Sir.
To come.
Sir, my name is Laura Elizabeth Lacey.
It's Laura, yeah.
Laura, yes.
Yeah.
I feel like I probably have to apologize twice here. As he mentioned, there's not anybody backed up behind me, so I don't feel quite so bad. But I'd like to add a question.
Sure.
Connected to his question and your response. Since it has come out that Judge Clarence Pubicare, my Pepsi Thomas, has been found to be connected to some of the corporations that were pushing for the Citizens United case,
yeah.
Isn't there a remedy where we can roll back this decision? There's got to be something to do. Otherwise, a poison Supreme Court,
yep,
takes away our constitutional checks and balances.
Yep. There's a case that actually a lawsuit has been filed by another group, Public Citizen, arguing that very case. And the problem is that there's no court higher than the Supreme Court. Maybe the Supremes, I don't know. But the Supreme Court on questions of conflicts of interest, unlike some of the lower courts at the district court level, the appellate courts, where there's always another level of the court to turn to, it's basically self-policed. And so if Justice Thomas felt that he was able to render an opinion in that case and it didn't have a conflict, there really is nowhere else to turn to for a kind of a second opinion. And it's also true that it's the Supreme Court justices are very skittish about turning on each other. Even when they disagree vehemently on some of the policy matters, there's a gentle person feeling to the 9 members of the court where they're unlikely to take each other on at loggerheads. I find it interesting that Justice Stevens has been much more vocal now as he's off the bench than he was when he was on the bench, because he's somewhat freed up by the niceness that's required of the court. It's also true that in some instances, there's also been, I thought you were going to also go with the allegations that Clarence Thomas's wife had been involved with some of the right-wing groups. And there are concerns there. I mean, certainly there are questions that should be put to the justices. They should be asked to explain them. It's not without its complexities. I mean, you got to remember, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a staff lawyer at the ACLU who argued our women's rights docket. Then she became the director of the Women's Rights Project. Then she became the general counsel of the ACLU. There are many on the far right who always argue that Justice Ginsburg should recuse herself on all ACLU cases that come before the court because she had been employed by us. That would knock out, in all of our cases, that would knock out a very critical vote. So it's not without its concerns about how it might play out in future efforts. But you know, I take your point. I think some of the ways in which this came out, especially in the press, and especially when they had been paid to travel to these conferences to speak to individuals on cases that were yet not determined by the Supreme Court, raise enormous questions. Thank you very much for turning out tonight.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage with Anthony Romero, National Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, also known as the ACLU. Mr. Romero responded to questions from audience members following his talk entitled Disparate Opportunity in America, The Ongoing Struggle for Equal Rights, recorded at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium on July 14, 2011. A special thanks to the folks at UAA who provided audio for this week's program. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our new website, alaskapublic.org. to let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.